Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry going forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can get a notification whenever we go live every Thursday at 2. Jeff, how are you doing this week?
I'm well, David. How about you?
I'm doing well. Oh, I forgot to say, make sure that if you want to sponsor the podcast, industrial media president Tom Lynch, tom@ien.com will sponsor the podcast in the subject line. Help us out. Jeff, how are you doing again?
Still okay.
Still great. No, just okay. Just okay.
Well, okay.
Sure. Okay, just in there.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Jeff's feeling it today. How you doing, Anna?
Still not over that thing from last week, huh?
No, I literally just forgot it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, am I ever over things?
No.
No, no. Sorry, personal failing. But if you embrace it, it's okay. All right. Well, before we jump into our first story this week, we have a word from our new sponsor, Weavix. Weavix is the leader in frontline communication, offering push-to-talk multimedia capabilities and AI-powered language translation that empowers the frontline through a Walt smart radio. Now, Weavix is the first to introduce safety-compliant music, breaking the monotony of everyday work. Always ensure you have the ear of the worker while enhancing worker safety and connectivity. With adaptive music controls, compliant with OSHA regulations, geofencing for restricted areas, and customizable volume settings, safety is prioritized while boosting worker satisfaction. Utilize Weavix to drive frontline engagement and increase worker retention. Explore how Weavix is transforming frontline operations at Weavix.com. And you're right, Doug, it is two-ish. All right, our first story this week. U.S. to give $6.1 billion to Micron Technology for chip plants in New York and Idaho. Micron Technology will receive $6.1 billion in government support to make advanced memory computer chips in New York and Idaho. Micron will ultimately build four chip factories near Syracuse in the town of Clay. Collectively, it will make up the biggest memory chip plant in America. In total, Micron will invest $100 billion in upstate New York over the next 20 years. The project will create 9,000 direct jobs and 40,000 construction jobs. Micron will also build a $15 billion memory chip plant in Boise, the company's hometown. Jeff, we've seen a lot of promises lately. Will this one be delivered?
Don't know. big to be continued on this one, because as the article pointed out, we actually ran another piece today kind of dissecting this a little bit more about how President Biden has made all these promises and all these chip manufacturers are making big plans for investing here, Ohio, Texas, other places. We won't know for a couple of years here, because the average plant does take like 3 years to build, 3 to 5 years to build, and costs about $10 billion. Mm-hmm. So even the $6 billion we're giving them here, it doesn't really cover the complete cost. And they did make a point of saying they're going to invest tens of billions of dollars more in this area. I think it's healthy and it's understandable to be skeptical of these types of situations, 100%, especially because essentially Biden's going, look, I laid the groundwork. Somebody else has got to make sure they don't screw it up.
Yeah.
That's basically what he's saying. But I think there's a lot of reasons to be positive here. Number one, when you look at Micron, this is a company that is based in the U.S. You know, they made a comparison potentially to Foxconn, which just,
you know,
grates everybody, especially here, whenever that name is brought up. But because it is a U.S.-based manufacturer, I think that lends a little bit more solace when you're looking at this, makes you feel a little bit better about it. I think also when you look at it from a competitive perspective or a market perspective, I should say, if you're going to roll the dice in an area of manufacturing, this is a really good one. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what else you're going to look for. We've seen automotive manufacturers go up and down. We've talked about trying to bring textiles back to the U.S. A lot more gamble, a lot more risk associated there than when you look at the market and where we're going with, especially memory-based chips. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Micron is a market leader there. You also look at the geography. It makes a ton of sense when you go to Syracuse because of the biggest thing you need for a chip maker is water.
Water.
And they're right next to the Great Lakes. So there's a lot of reasons to see how this one should, could, feeling good about it working out.
Yeah.
But, you know, the reality is time will tell. But I think there's a lot of positive momentum here.
Well, and it is a collection of four plants. And they did indicate that the $6 billion is for the first two plants. So I feel confident that at least the first two will happen. But, I mean, you're right. Like, Biden is campaigning on the future, which is a hard message when we're kind of a near instant gratification culture right now. Anna, your thoughts on the deal with Micron. Does it pass the sniff test a little bit better than the Foxconn deal?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, they threw out some really big numbers in the article. And of course, I think like a 20-year projection from them is like, I mean, that is meaningless, right? And we like, and the thousands of jobs, like, of course, the billions of dollars, like everyone sees that and they're like, you know, what's going to really happen? But we are seeing the CHIPS and Science Act kind of come together. A lot has happened in the last few weeks alone in terms of allocating some funds to different companies. We saw Intel secure their funding, Samsung secure some funding to expand in Texas, billions of dollars for both those companies. It's interesting to me based on the timeline here because, you know, and you guys touched on some of this too, but you know, when this first became a massive priority, it was because of the pandemic era conditions that sort of arose when, you know, supply chain issues were taking place. National security concerns kind of came to light, I think, during that time where everyone collectively realized, hey, we could easily be screwed in so many ways here if we don't get a handle on domestic production of chips. But I think people have short memories. So, you know, I mean, like I just read an article about all the money that was dumped into domestic manufacturing of PPE around the pandemic and how little there is to show for it now because of the demand cliff and people's, I think, general disinterest in pandemic era anything because they've moved on. You know, people aren't buying masks anymore. They're not buying extra gloves. Like nobody's got a, I used to have all the packs of that stuff in my house, you know.
Yeah. Our last mask was just used as an emergency tissue in the car the other day.
Yeah. Put it in this mask.
So we need to, I'll re-up.
It's not the same thing, right?
Yeah.
But I hope people don't lose interest or momentum. This was a problem before, and it was the pandemic that kind of brought it to light. But the impacts, you know, we just talked about that AP article that we ran today about the Biden administration and kind of working through this long game and hoping that voters realize what's happening here and see it for what it is. But yeah, right now it is more of a promise than a conclusion. We have to see it play out. I do think it's an important project. As you said, of all of the areas to be investing in, this is the one. I mean, like this is not like a flash in the pan issue where we're going to suddenly not need chips. Like we need them for everything now. We have no domestic production really at this point. I think it's a good allocation of resources. If you are going to pick an industry, this is the one to pick. I totally agree. So hopefully all these companies involved will come through on the claims that they have made in terms of the investments and the dollars and the jobs. But even if it's a fraction of that, and we, instead of 20% of chips produced in the U.S., it's 10. I mean, that's still a massive, massive improvement from where we're at right now.
Well, and comparing it to PPE, like PPE was at the time re-sunk money into it because it seemed like it was a need for the kind of the indefinite future, you know, until things kind of fizzled out. Whereas unless the grid goes dark, there will be a demand for more and more advanced chips. I mean, we're talking about AI applications that are so so hungry for processing power. You know, we're talking about needing hundreds of millions of chips to run these types of technologies. One thing I was kind of curious about is it was something like $52 billion has been sent or was part of the CHIPS Act, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I was kind of curious, is that enough? I was looking at since 2014, China has invested like $150 billion in its chip industry.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just focusing on like competing with like the legacy chip market. So the ones that are already out there where like US is more focused on advanced manufacturing techniques and these advanced chips suited to AI. I was wondering, is that going to be enough in the long run? Are we looking at more long-term investments similar to this that are going to kind of need to help us get over that hump?
Like a recurring investment?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to compare too with China. Like, so is $150 billion, is that, you know, state-owned companies right. where that money is like one and the same as private public, whereas like $52 billion, that's just from the federal government. There's yeah. billions and billions, hundreds of billions on top of that that's coming from private funding.
Yeah, this was specific government funding and grants.
I just, you know, those yeah. companies are owned by the government. That's yeah. what I mean. So yeah. it's like...
Okay.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I don't know if it's the same number, I guess, as like apples to apples.
Gotcha. All right. Well, I was just curious if mm-hmm. it might take a little bit more. Clearly not.
Well, no, it's it might. That's not what I'm saying.
It's definitely going to take more. I would agree with Anna. I don't think it's going to come from the government. I think, you know, Micron here, they were saying they're going to stick another $100 billion over the next decade, two decades, whatever it is.
20 years, yeah.
Into this very specific geography, not including any place else, just right there. So like to Anna's point, it's going to be a lot more market driven in terms of what comes next. This was laying the foundation.
Yeah. So Anna, the Biden administration is asking for people to see this as a 20-year investment, mm-hmm. the foundation of the future. Do you think he's going to even make it another 7 months where people are still remembering it?
I wasn't sure exactly what you were asking.
Oh,
I
was
like,
yeesh. Get a little dark.
No, just memory.
There's a reason why politicians don't like to touch this stuff. It's too long term because by the time it is realized, they don't get the benefit politically for it. You know, and I mean, this is the same with infrastructure. We talked about that before. It's just like it's too much of a long term project. It's too much of a long game. So that's why. You don't see it's politicians struggle to get the stuff off the ground.
Yeah.
I think the pandemic was enough of an impetus. You had a lot of public support and a lot of bipartisan support for some stuff like this that maybe you wouldn't pass in another time period. So maybe we just got, I don't want to say got lucky there, but you know,
yeah.
I mean, it was the right circumstances maybe.
Okay. Our next most popular story this week, world's largest hydrogen ships are being built in Norway. We're not going to need a bigger boat because after a long design and development process, the two largest hydrogen powered ships in the world are now being built in Norway. The ships are both 384 feet long and being made for the country's longest ferry route. They will carry 120 cars and 599 passengers. Just didn't have room for one more. The route is known as one of the longest and most challenging for ferries in Norway. So, the ships will have closed car decks and a special hull design for safer operation in exposed waters. The ferries will also carry the largest hydrogen installation ever found on a ship. Each ship will have 6,400 kilowatt of fuel cells of compressed hydrogen. They're intended to be 100% zero emission, but they'll rely on a multi-hybrid propulsion system with hydrogen electric as the primary mode and diesel electric for secondary mode. The ferries should be done in 2026. Jeff, that's a big ship. I mean,
big ship needs a lot of power.
Needs a lot of power. And it's almost like a very huge proof of concept.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit more based on where it's being utilized. I think it's really interesting because I'll be honest, I started digging into like energy numbers and I was getting a lot of math coming up and I was getting really confused because that's not my thing.
Well, I could have helped you. I could have helped you with that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. David's super good at math.
That's
I forgot.
Right. Super good at math. Just beautiful mind this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Hold on. Without even knowing the numbers, I could give you the answer.
So why don't you just tell me if I'm right?
Okay.
Can we just do it that way?
Sure. I stand by it.
So one of the things, whenever we talk about hydrogen, it's not about the application because we know the emissions and all that good stuff. It's very efficient, offers a great range. All those things are positive. It all goes into what it costs to, or what the costs are with the effects of producing the hydrogen itself. So doing a little bit of research, we're looking at almost like 17 pounds of coal to produce 1 kilogram of hydrogen. This needs about 190 kilograms of hydrogen to power those fuel cells. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, typically when we're looking at power grid, for example, that would be an issue. But what's so cool or very interesting here in Norway is like 98% of their energy that goes to the grid to produce electricity comes from hydropower. Mm. It comes from their dams. They also are very good with wind power. It's like 1.1% of the electricity generated in the entire country comes from fossil fuels.
That's incredible.
So they've kind of figured that part out of it. Yeah. So in that instance, this makes a ton of sense. You call it a proof of concept to start playing around with this in this geography because they've got a very efficient way of producing the hydrogen mm-hmm. and then putting it into practical application. So I think this is really, really interesting. It is going to be a really great proof of concept in terms of, does this show us how to do it better? You know, yeah. Is there a larger scale application? Because typically when we looked at hydrogen, we're like, hey, maybe for a campus, maybe for a set place where you're producing things on site, or it's almost a subsidiary type product that you can use internally. Here, like I said, I get it. I don't know if this is the right fit beyond this particular situation, but in this one, when you're looking at reducing, I think it said something like 26,000 tons of hydrocarbons would be removed yeah. or fewer fossil fuel emissions by making this switch. Mm. Yeah, that's real.
Yeah.
I mean, so I do like it in this instance. And again, because of how the hydrogen will be created, I think it does make a lot of sense here.
Well, and you're right. Your numbers do check out.
Thank you.
And but we typically, when we're talking about hydrogen, we're talking about it like plants, campuses, fleets, right? And really, a ferry system is still kind of a closed loop system.
Potentially on how they're sourcing it.
Yeah. Just in terms of like, you know, ferries going A to B mm-hmm. and then it's going
port back. To port. Yep.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on the potential hydrogen has, you know, just because we're going to see a lot of changes coming when it comes to maritime?
Yeah, it was interesting. So I did a little digging into this too, and I found this interesting article published by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. They cited experts who said that despite private and public interest in decarbonization, the immediate prospects for global shipping are not clear because currently international shipping uses virtually no low carbon fuels. So to reach the International Maritime Organization's goals for a 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, industry leaders say that the first net zero ships must enter the global fleet by 2030. That is very soon.
Yeah.
But they say that of the clean fuel options that are being piloted now, hydrogen is the clear winner in this circumstance. And they say that one of the big advantages is the relative, I did not know this, the relative ease in retrofitting existing ships, with the technology.
Yeah.
They said they have a massive head start over other technologies that require like a full rework from the ground up. And they say that in fact, hydrogen fuel could replace 43% of voyages between the US and China without any changes and 99% of voyages with minor changes to fuel capacity or operations. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you think about how everyone, that's such a huge barrier to alternative fuels at this point or alternative energies of all kinds. Is just the cost, you know, like to think that you could just kind of plug and play. Obviously, there's other things to be, you know, done here around refilling. That's mm-hmm. not quite a mature market. And so that's one of the things that you have to look at as another challenge. The other is the space that hydrogen fuel cells take up on a cargo ship. So they said that shippers tend to be losing maybe, for example, like 5% of speculative cargo space on each ship.
That's significant.
Which is significant, right?
Yeah.
So if there's no requirement for them to do it and there's no, public, you know, green sustainability initiative that's driving their efforts to do that, you're going to get a lot of shipping companies, logistics companies who are not going to do it. I mean, there's cost related to the fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you're losing capacity, that's going to be another challenge. So there are challenges to it. I was interested to see how easy it is to retrofit these ships. I had no idea.
Yeah.
So it seems like, you could be halfway there. And maybe if shippers are incentivized to make the switch, kind of taking into account the fact that they're losing some capacity and then that's going to be a deterrent. I don't know how you incentivize them to do that money, right?
Yeah.
I guess is the only way. But just kind of getting that off the ground, I think it could be great, you know?
Yeah, money to make it happen. And then money in terms of if you don't make it happen, we're going to fine you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is going to hopefully cost more than the 5% loss.
Maybe.
So what were some of those numbers that you were talking about in terms of savings? Just because one thing that I noticed about this Norwegian ship design is that this isn't necessarily their first rodeo, right? Like a lot of their work has been on upgrading older vessels to help reduce carbon footprints, mainly switching vessels to EVs. But like, so they actually have a history in this. But when I was thinking about it, as we were kind of putting together this story, I was curious, like, is this one of those things where like, okay, switching all of these over is still isn't going to be like a drop in the bucket to like, you know, mass adoption of EV vehicles, you know? Or I mean, that's why I was curious about some of the numbers you were sharing.
Oh, sure. I mean, global shipping is responsible for a ton of emissions. Like, I mean, that's very greenhouse gas heavy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that, and I don't want to spit a number out that I don't know for sure, but I do know that it's significant. So, I mean, yeah, automotive's doing its thing, but like maritime has to do its thing too.
Yeah. Understood. I mean,
it's a completely different thing, but.
Well, one thing that, well, it's just sometimes when we talk about like, how you got to do all the little things in order for them to like really have a cumulative effect.
Everything adds up.
Yeah. It was just like, okay, it would be great if we could do this. Would it have a substantial impact? Jeff, one thing I was thinking about is, I mean, these guys have been working on the project since 2019. And I actually really appreciated one of the people working on the project. His quote was, you know what? I'm excited to finally start building ferries. Because it's been 5 years of preliminary approvals, safety analyses, model tests. And they're finally getting to, you know, build something in a shipyard. And I think sometimes, you know, when we see these new products come to light, we don't really think of the development that goes on behind the scenes and just how, like, you know, emotionally and mentally taxing that is. And sometimes, you know, the products never get made.
I think the one thing, too, will be interesting once this actually gets put in the water. I mean, they do have diesel electric as the secondary mode of power. Yeah. How much that gets relied upon or used. I mean, if you're running a little bit behind, these are notoriously rough seas. Are they going to need more power potentially? And I think that would have a big impact too going forward in terms of does this lead to being used in other applications or other maritime type vessels? So,
well, and the other thing is safety, right? So it seems like safety is, you know, of like greatest importance. You know, hydrogen fueled passenger transportation over such a long and demanding route like you were talking about, never really been tried before anywhere else in the world. But it does seem like it does. It seems like the right team to be approaching it from a safety standpoint. Like all the boxes have been checked from a safety standpoint.
I think that's one thing that sometimes we overlook when we're talking about hydrogen as a fuel source. I mean, there are huge issues with the combustibility of hydrogen. So especially if you're on a boat.
Yep. Boat, airship, anywhere that you're like locked in.
Yeah.
All right. Our next most popular story, Hyundai to test new humanoid robot from Boston Dynamics. 9 days ago, Boston Dynamics said goodbye to the HD Atlas, the hydraulic robot that has often gone viral due to it taking just some brutal dingers. It wasn't the most nimble, as the company showcased in this best of video. But you know what? It had a good run. HD had a good run. I mean, and if you haven't seen the video of them just abusing that thing with the hockey stick, you got to look it up immediately. The next day, Boston Dynamics introduced the all-new Atlas in a brief and notably terrifying clip. The new Atlas is agile and can lift heavy and irregular objects. And in bigger news, Hyundai is bringing the new Atlas in-house to build, quote, the next generation of automotive manufacturing capabilities. In additional robot news, Mobileye founder Amnon Shashua debuted his new company, Menti Robotics. The company's Menti bot is going to be able to handle a wide spectrum of activities in both households and industrial warehouses while responding to verbal commands, helping to direct navigation, locomotion, scene understanding, object detection, and localization, as well as grasping and just natural language understanding. Menti Robotics wants to have a production-ready prototype deployed by the first quarter of next year. Finally, NVIDIA also unveiled Project Groot, which the company is calling a, quote, general-purpose foundation model for humanoid robots. The platform is designed to help robots understand natural language and emulate movements while observing human actions. Anna, we're getting closer, and if they need to observe natural language, I just really hope they don't feed them the stuff I'm just garbling out of here.
Don't listen to the podcast.
Yeah, it's getting closer.
Is it?
It's getting close.
I don't know. To me, like, so it's interesting that these announcements have been coming one after another. First, you had Tesla, then you had BMW, then Mercedes-Benz, now Hyundai. So I think the question there is this a reasonable opportunity for automakers to become more efficient? Mm-hmm. Or is this automakers wanting to maintain the impression that they are competitive from a technological standpoint? It's easy to say, like, hey, we're looking at it. Hey, yeah. So we're also looking at it, like, yeah. Just like lemmings.
And making sure they're not getting left behind in the event that there's something there.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't my perspective is I'm a wait and see on this, but more of a negative wait and see. So, OK, so when we ran a story on BMW's humanoid robot project announcement a few months back, I suppose. Mm-hmm. We quoted reporters at Popular Science who characterized the project's goals as vague, adding that in general, quote, the sci-fi promise of a relentless, hyper-efficient, never-sleeping robot workforce for the time being remains mostly speculative. I thought that was harsh at the time, but also kind of aligns with what I've seen here.
Yeah.
Like, it's a form factor that I think it's getting a lot of attention, but it's really untested. People don't like it. It's very small scale right now. It's very costly. You know, the big benefit, I think, would be in enabling plants to, like, fit their existing processes to a human-like size or shape automated system. Mm-hmm. Is that enough, though, for what it's going to cost? We see companies retool all the time and, you know, to enable what their new equipment and their automated processes. It's, like, cumbersome as any integration is, but it's not the end of the world. They do it all the time. I can see this as something to maybe experiment with, but I don't know. I mean, especially, I guess, if there's, like, longer term concerns around skill gaps or, you know, we're seeing, like, maybe mass unionization of the automotive industry, that could be another reason that they're like, mm-hmm. What if we have to replace all of our people because it gets too expensive? You know, I guess you could see that, like, that as being like, hey, maybe we could create this plug and play replacement for a human. Like, somebody calls out sick and we can just put this bot Atlas guy in there. But I don't know. For now, I just don't see how you practically apply this, you know. And I think automakers will dabble, but I'll be surprised if we see any kind of mass adoption of this technology or large scale deployments in the near future. I just don't see it yet. And like I said, I think it's just maybe a lot of competitive posturing at this point. Maybe someday, but it's just not there yet.
Well, I think a big part of the BMW, and I think it was Agility Robotics comparison, is that BMW is going to have them doing, like, very repetitive, redundant, simple tasks. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that was very interesting about the Atlas in particular, is that it can hold irregular shapes. It can hold heavier shapes, because that was another restriction with humanoid robots. It was, well, they can't really lift that much anyways. Mm-hmm. So I think that if this isn't, obviously it's just, there's no other way to say other than this is clearly the thing that leads to the thing. I'm just trying to dance around it and I'm coming up. But I think that we have seen how these partnerships have already created a dialogue with robotic specialists and automakers and other companies. And these tweaks and these changes are already happening. So, and part of automation is that they happen at just, like, lightning speed. So I don't know.
I just don't see this happening at lightning speed. I just don't.
Okay. No. Well, Jeff, I just want to say, can we timestamp this? Because for me, it's not if or how, it's when these humanoid robots are in factories. But I feel like, you know, normally you take the other side of that.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with that. I'll be consistent and agree with Anna. Here's the thing. First of all, robotics is going to continue to grow, become more advanced, more capable. Right now, we're drawn to this humanoid factor because it resembles us.
Yeah.
And that's the way factories are set up right now, from a production perspective, from a process perspective, from a workflow perspective. It's meant to have an individual, so the conveyor belt comes through at about waist level, and everything else is ergonomically fixed because of how we're made.
Yeah.
And that's why we're drawn to the humanoid. When you look at the advancement and how long it's going to take for these to become affordable and therefore scalable, mm-hmm. I don't see us having factories set up the same way. I think robotics are going to continue to advance to a point where, I mean, look at everything that's gone with AMRs right now in a warehouse and what they can do. They don't look like humanoids, okay? Yeah. They're basically tables with wheels that are able to go and grab stuff and do picks and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's that type of functionality that's going to win out over the humanoid footprint, if you will, or that design. So I think robotics is going to continue to grow and do more. We're going to see more, you know, more arms, more, like I said, stuff running around on warehouses and sourcing materials and stuff like that. I just don't see humanoid robots replacing, coming out into the scale that makes them affordable.
Yeah.
You know, for an application in a plant. The other thing that kind of freaks me out as we kind of go down this road, and I was, you know, we got the Security Breach podcast and we talk about this expanding number of endpoints as we add more and more security. A robot's an endpoint. They're the one that's doing the that job at a particular spot. And if we give them more and more responsibility, that's also becomes a hackable workforce, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That can also become very frightening. And that also adds additional costs onto getting these robots into these plants. So when you look at all of those things, I don't think the future is all that bright for humanoids, but I think for robots being integrated within production systems and more advanced automation processes, yes. I just don't like this footprint.
Are you predicting murder bots?
No, I'm saying—
You said frightening, so I was kind of like, what does he mean?
More like shut them down so you can't do anything.
Oh, gotcha. One thing that I was encouraged by is this NVIDIA Project Groot. Because I can't remember with the BMW story, we talked about how AI is enabling a lot more of the processing power it takes to treat these robots, which is why I think we're seeing such advancements in humanoid robots that even a year ago wasn't even really fathomable to most people. So I'm really fascinated to see how NVIDIA's Project Groot is used as a foundation. But I understand your point where like you envision a future where it's more automated carts with robotic arms doing various tasks because it doesn't need to be a robot.
A humanoid.
Yeah, but it is. I still buy into the idea that, you know, it's also a humanoid robot because you can essentially download some of that tribal knowledge now in human tasks and put it into a robot. Also,
Theory, though, I mean, like just how all the tribal knowledge that you learned how to drive a car is like translating perfectly into autonomous vehicles. We've noticed that, right?
Yes, it's pretty seamless. I've been checking the papers and I think everything's gone swimmingly.
Nothing wrong.
Not a thing. Jeff, the other point.
What did they do? Cut the price on something with their autopilot because it wasn't working?
Actually, I don't think they cut the price. I believe when it's that steep, it's slashed.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, the other thing, though, is what was one of the biggest complaints about the new non-compete law, right, is that it's going to make people more vulnerable to losing IP and trade secrets. Well, now if you can lock those inside your Atlas.
Oh, yeah,
because
we can't get those out of a computer at all.
No.
Nobody would ever try to do that.
Safer.
Oh, wait a minute.
Way safer.
Oh, wait a minute.
And I know that I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but if you haven't yet seen the Mitchells versus the Machines, you need to. And the new Atlas just looks so much like a first generation of that robot. It's eerie, even the way that it moves, like because they have the joints, you know, the universal joints.
That was
and stuff
uncomfortable.
Like that. It is. See, I like how Boston Dynamics is leaning into like, you know what? They're creepy anyways, so we're just going to make it completely functional. You want it to stand up like a bug? All right. It's unsettling. All right. Our next most popular story this week, BAE to modernize World War II era ammunition plant. BAE Systems, Ordnance Systems, a bit of a redundant name, recently picked a partner to update the Radford Army Ammunition Plant, a World War II era facility vital to national security. The company picked Hanwha Defense USA, a U.S. defense subsidiary of South Korean company Hanwha Aerospace. This company is going to modernize the government-owned and contractor-operated facility in Radford, Virginia. Hanwha will help integrate advanced chemical processing capabilities into BAE's manufacturing environment. BAE actually has a history of modernizing while continuing to manufacture. The company hopes its new efforts and Hanwha's previous experience will result in state-of-the-art propellant manufacturing processing. Oh no, a state-of-the-art
process. See, that's what I meant about not using this language to feed the machines. Use someone else. Hanwha recently completed similar efforts at the company's energetics facilities in Korea. BAE has been the operating contractor of the Radford plant since 2012. In December 2023, the company also received a contract to continue operating the Holston Army Ammunition Plant in Kingsport, Tennessee through 2035. Jeff, these facilities, in order to keep running efficiently and, you know, to still be state-of-the-art facilities, I mean, they need a little TLC every once in a while.
Well, especially when you're dealing with propellants. Yeah. We definitely want to keep those factories updated and as safe as possible. I mean, it's not recent history, but there are some pretty big things that have happened at this facility over the years.
Oh, yeah.
I'll let you get to those if you get that lined
oh,
up.
Oh, no. Go ahead. Tee it up.
No, no. You enjoy those way too much.
I mean, it was just, it was like you're looking into the history like, oh, who owned the contract before? Oh, my goodness. It went so bad. It was so bad.
There's some bad stuff. So anyway, but I think what this is really a bigger part of is we keep talking about all these missile advancements. Well, it's focused on a lot of things going on in the world right now, specifically over in Asia. There are definitely thought leaders out there who feel like we don't have enough missiles right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When it comes to arming our naval aircraft, our naval vessels, they feel like if we got into a real war type situation, we would run out, which we don't want to send people in any sooner than we need to. So being able to do things from a further distance away is obviously better, optimal. Yeah. So I think that's what you're seeing here. It's part of this in terms of upgrading this facility, putting in some things that are going to help them to be more efficient, automate processes, hopefully be a lot safer, help the employees out there as well. I think it was a little bit ironic that we have a South Korean company assisting in the manufacture when, again, the primary application could be China, North Korea, things like that. So, but I think this is something that we're realizing here closer to home. That's part of a bigger global situation.
Yeah. So just a little bit on that history, if you don't mind me getting into it.
Go for it. Yeah.
So the facilities owned by the government, operated by contractors through facility use contracts. And BAE took over the contract May 2011, started in 2012. But they're working with some hazardous stuff. So in October last year, BAE received $47 million from the Army to replace a legacy nitroglycerin facility. Now, this work should be done by April 2026. But some of the work there, just looking into it, they've had some tragic accidents. From 1970 to 1985, there were 9 major explosions at the facility that caused multiple deaths, millions of dollars in damage, notably an explosion that was the equivalent to 8,600 pounds of dynamite destroyed the plant's TNT manufacturing facility. It also injured 100 workers back in 1974. In 1985, a 5,000-pound nitroglycerin explosion killed 2 employees and left a crater that was a half acre in size.
Oof.
So
that's what got me, a half acre.
That's a big one. Wow. But it's also, so I know that we sometimes talk about the price tags on these and like, does it really cost that much? But sometimes you just really want to make sure they get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Like nitroglycerin. That's one. You know what?
Let's be careful.
Yeah, let's be careful.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that this facility was built in the 1940s and designed to support the war effort at that time. And it's, according to BAE, played an important role in every American conflict since then. A lot of times when you read stories about plants that are 80 years old, it's about them shutting down.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about how they're being revitalized and used. It's about how they're too expensive to retool and we can't make it work, so we're going to lay off 200 people or whatever. So what's interesting about this location, obviously outside of its crazy history, is that the support structure behind the plant's ability to persist is in part by its participation in this program called Armament Retooling and Manufacturing Support Program, or ARMS. And the idea behind ARMS is to support firms when possible to use these like eligible facilities in ways that help the U.S. Meet industrial emergency like requirements for national security purposes. And then part of that is in reducing costs, too. So like they help with things like recapitalization of a plant, equipment. They help with environmental remediation. So like maybe this nitrogen crater. And then they also prevent government costs related to shutting them down and actually having to clean that site, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, like, part of it is that it's, like, it's the government's vested interest, both strategically and economically, in keeping these long-running plants operational in order to service defense needs and then also, you know, keep the cost down of having to be on the hook for cleaning them up, I guess.
Make sure it doesn't become a Superfund site.
Yeah. So, I think that's why, like, this type of situation, you don't see that as much in the private sector, because the government is kind of aiding this process and keeping this plant alive. And you can see why they're doing it. They, you know, it obviously serves a very important defense mechanism here, but still, yeah, crazy when they're like, yeah, it's really old and it has this crazy history and lots of explosions and stuff, but we are sticking with it.
Is there something to that where if there was a facility or a manufacturing process or a particular product that's being made that was deemed hazardous waste or an environmental risk, that's maybe a little bit more ongoing or upfront investment from the government could help stem potential disasters going down the line? I mean, I understand that nobody wants to hear like more of a public and private handshake, but also I just think of how when you look through the FDA's press releases and how there are always just throwing tens and hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars at these Superfund sites. Maybe there could be a little bit something there where it was more of a public-private partnership.
Like a preventive type program that tries to keep it from like, you know, before it's in the soil.
Yeah. Just like, hey, we know what you're doing here.
Yeah.
Let's just let us step in and like help take care of the facility so that way it's not a blight or a really serious problem in the future.
I know. It's crazy though. Cause like, I mean, you know, these companies will just walk away and then they're bankrupt and there's nothing that you can do to like claw back any money, and then who else is going to clean it up?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, Jeff, too unreasonable?
No, I think we've gotten a lot better there in terms of things that you do need to meet certain requirements for manufacturing certain products or using chemicals in these facilities. So I think we've gotten better there for, you know, if we could work backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, you always get into that argument then, how much are we actually subsidizing then private industry and things like that. But to your point, I'd rather do that up front than deal with the ramifications afterwards.
It's just like a national preventative maintenance.
And it's one of those weird things, like in the right situation, makes a ton of sense, but there's always going to be somebody to manipulate it.
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, sure. There always is.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, how many times do we have to hear the story of like another thing opened and dumped X thousands of gallons of toxic chemical X into the lake?
Yeah.
Maybe don't swim this summer. You know, just... Yeah. Maybe we could get ahead of it.
I hear you.
All right. Well, our most popular story this week kind of surprised me. So hold on to your boots here. Raccoon knocks out electricity for thousands in Wisconsin. On Saturday evening, southeastern Wisconsin substation went dark. Some 16,000 people lost power. According to We Energies, a Wisconsin utility company, that culprit was a raccoon. The raccoon touched two pieces of equipment simultaneously, which is just no good for the grid or the raccoon alike. The utility restored power relatively quickly. The lights were back on for most residents in a matter of hours. But it's crazy that animals cause significant power problems every year. Squirrels are behind most animal-related power outages, followed by raccoons and birds. But they're not alone. In what is a more curious case that happened in New Jersey, a power outage was actually caused by a flying fish that knocked out service to more than 2,000 people. And I know what you're thinking. Huh? Local.
Huh?
Just like, did I hear that right? Just hit that 15-second back button on the on your device. Local authorities, which named this fried fish culprit Gilligan, say the fish likely fell from the talons of a bird of prey, like an osprey. Every year, some 13 million people in the U.S. lose power due to animal contact. These outages can cost utility companies up to $18 million per year. This is according to Utility Products. Anna, regardless of how it happens, all downtime is costly, even if it was caused by a flying fish.
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say that I love raccoons. So I don't want anything disparaging to be said about them. However, yeah, I mean, this is like, so obviously the power implications here, crazy. This impacted so many people in these communities, but there's a lot of pest management and animal issues that need to be addressed in manufacturing as well. Like plants are dealing with pest issues all the time, right? We see food manufacturers dealing with pests probably the most. Mm-hmm. They got some enticing stuff behind their doors. and they also have, you know, ingredient stockpiles and, you know, just it's challenging for those companies as they try to retain a sanitary environment. And then you have everything from bugs and cockroaches to rodents, birds. Many facilities struggle with birds because of their open bay doors and stuff. And so
there was like that lion in India. The lion just came walking into the factory.
Yeah, there was a bear in. I can't
remember the bear.
Yeah, mm-hmm. like a black bear just wandered into somebody's factory a couple of years back. And it just happens. I mean, it doesn't happen all the time. It's not like factories are not overrun with bears. but like birds, I mean, that could happen any day,
yeah.
Right?
Oh yeah.
And you have to think about too, if like not just food plants, but any factory that is like inventory intense has a lot of product there. Like you can easily spoil a product. You can easily wreck a product with like one even small infestation. So I think the important takeaway here is that, you know, this type of disruptive and expensive impact is happening on a regular basis for manufacturers as well, especially in food plants. There's a lot to be said about strategies around like integrated pest management, which is sort of like prevention, training, targeted sanitation, stuff like that. But I think the worrisome part is that so much of the prevention side comes down to employees understanding what to do right. And so when you're in an industry like food manufacturing or you're working at a dock, like those are positions where turnover tends to be high anyway. Right mm-hmm. now it's really high. And so that's, I think, when it starts to become a little bit more worrisome because the gaps start to occur.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, the financial implications here are huge. And so I think like, it's not just an issue of, do you understand how to handle your pest management, but also like, how was your training program? How was your retention program? Because all of these are going to be factors in how this type of problem will impact a manufacturer. There's some things that you can't avoid. You can't avoid like opening up your dock to a truck, right? Like you have to do that. But one thing that you can get in front of is making sure that your employees understand what to do. So just something to consider, I think, as these plants deal with more and more turnover is just making sure that message is consistent.
Well, and you know, don't leave the doors open. But you know what? I understand if you're sitting there during the training and all of a sudden the programming switches to how to keep raccoons out of the dock.
Yeah.
And you're just like, check out of this one.
How to keep bears out of the plant.
Right.
I would listen to that a lot.
Consistent and reoccurring problem of bears.
Well, yeah. Jeff, Anna talks about the risk, but I mean, it's so unlikely that, let's say, a bird drops a fish on a station that knocks out power. But we saw just a couple of weeks ago where a food manufacturer went under because one cold storage facility went bad, and now that company's out of business. So I know that it sounds odd and cover a lot about how we go through this risk mitigation. But I mean, talk about planning for everything.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of things with this story. First of all, I would have thought birds would be ahead of squirrels.
Yeah.
I was surprised. I thought birds would be the number one animal thing. But anyway, I'm also agreeing with your reference in the script or the write-up of the story. Raccoons are trash pandas.
I am
not going to defend raccoons. They are gross. They have their purpose, I guess.
Yeah. So. But you have to admit that like watching a video of a raccoon eat like a person, it's addictive.
I've seen them eat too many things that I think are, you know, gross.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'm not going to.
All right. Yeah, I mean, you've seen the raccoon get into the chicken coop and there's just no undoing that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I understand.
Can't go back. You know, I think reading this too, one of it, and Anna touched on it, and so did you. I think part of when we look at maintenance, we try to be predictive, preventative. And we really go over that, and we've done a great job in terms of those things and putting programs in place to make sure stuff doesn't happen. But then it is also being ready to remediate when things do happen. Mm-hmm. Having an answer to that what if mm-hmm. type of situation becomes more and more important. You know, that's something my wife works in banking, and one of her roles is business continuity. Yeah. I think that's something we may need to expand with a lot of our maintenance professionals and having them understand the response when things do go sideways that you couldn't have planned for, like an animal getting into stuff. That has to be just part of your day to day now in terms of being able to respond. Now, they were able to get back up and running pretty quick here.
Yeah.
But, you know, going into some of the examples, if you're a food manufacturer who depends on a freezer, if you're making ice cream in Wisconsin here, that's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. If it's the summer.
Yeah.
An hour is a lot of downtime.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you look at downtime, I think the most recent estimate is like $260,000 is what it costs manufacturers per hour for downtime.
Okay.
So, again, being able to remediate and respond to these situations and having an answer to that what if, that becomes more and more important and probably needs to be a greater focus of maintenance planning and processes.
Well, and stories like this are great because when you do adopt that business continuity into your company and you have to go through that brainstorming process, you can be like, all right, hear me out. We got to talk about raccoons and fish. Just like, what? Hear me out.
So many raccoon meetings happening.
I got to go to this raccoon meeting. It's what it says on the invite. I did want to call out one particular point from a reader, just in terms of the integrity of the grid. He made a really good point about the importance of, you know, power and generators for people with electrified medical devices. Mm-hmm. It was something that just came up recently because some members of the family recently had one of those backup generators, and you can like fill in like certain ports. Like you can only have like X amount of connect power, X amount of things. And so it's like my refrigerator, the chest freezer, and the outlet to my CPAP machine. Mm. And so it's just something that I'm becoming more aware of. And, you know, I think that shouldn't be neglected. And also the access to people with these sort of medical devices to make sure they do have the means to power them if the grid ever does go dark. All right. Well, before we move into, in case you missed it, we have another word from our new sponsor, Weavix. Weavix is the leader in frontline communication, offering push-to-talk multimedia capabilities and AI-powered language translation that empowers the frontline through a Walt Smart Radio. Now, Weavix is the first to introduce safety-compliant music, breaking the monotony of everyday work. Always ensure you have the ear of the worker while enhancing worker safety and connectivity. With adaptive music controls compliant with OSHA regulations, geofencing for restricted areas, and customizable volume settings, safety is prioritized while boosting worker satisfaction. Utilize Weavix to drive frontline engagement and increase worker retention. Explore how Weavix is transforming frontline operations at weavix.com. Anna, I have not heard of this concept before, and I thought it was pretty cool. Just the idea, because that's one thing we hear from the plant floor all the time, right? Is that, I mean, people want their devices.
Yeah.
They want their earbuds in. They want company Wi-Fi. And to me, it was always a safety concern, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is something where I didn't even know this was possible.
Yeah, there's so many audio alerts in a plant as well. So it's like safety compliant music is, it seems like a game changer in terms of retention for some workers, you know, like break the monotony and make their work environment great and they're going to stay. So I think that's very cool.
Yeah. And Jeff, it's kind of cool that you can also cut in with those safety alerts.
Yeah, that'd be a big part of it. Yeah, obviously. Just for worker retention and just, you know, satisfaction, you know, being in a better mood. Obviously, music does that.
I know that when I was sorting domes, I would have appreciated this.
Yeah, the key is to make sure it's not repetitive.
Like,
I remember I was in a couple of jobs too in manufacturing where you're working, you know, like an assembly table or something like that, and you have a radio station on that plays like the same 12 songs in a loop.
Yep. Yep. I knew that when I was stocking shelves every 11:45 a.m., Blue Christmas by Elvis would come on.
Whoa.
And it was bad. Bad. Wish I was a smoker. Just like smoke break. All right. On to, in case you missed it, the stories that maybe weren't as popular on the website, but could still make a big impact on the industry going forward. Jeff, I'd like to start with you this week. What do you have for in case you missed it?
I was actually really surprised this one didn't make the cut. I thought this was kind of a big story.
I know, me too.
This is the Tennessee Volkswagen employees overwhelmingly vote to join union. So there was a, you know, and this is a pretty high profile facility too. When you look at VW Chattanooga, this is one of those that was definitely sort of a You know, definitely on Sean Fain's radar, obviously, to get in sort of a flagship for a lot of these southern manufacturer automotive manufacturing plants. And they've got 73% of the ballots that were 73% of the ballots that were cast were in favor of joining the UAW. So they had about 83% of total of the facility that voted, 83 or 87. I have to double check that one. But so a huge number. It was overwhelmingly in terms of support, overwhelming support. So even if every single person voted there, it still would have passed. Mm-hmm. And I think this is going to be really interesting for a number of reasons. Obviously, if this goes through and there's no discrepancies, no issues, no arguments within 5 days, this will be a UAW facility.
Yeah.
So the first part of that then is UAW and VW Chattanooga are going to have to start negotiating. Mm-hmm. How is that going to go? How are these employees going to feel about a union coming in and speaking for them? Now, that is one of the things, one of the reasons they wanted them.
Yeah.
Because they saw everything the UAW got for all these other facilities. But how is that negotiation process going to go? How is VW going to respond to that? They're saying all the right things right now, but that can get pretty contentious pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the biggest differences here, and I'm sure the UAW is very well aware of this, I'm growing more and more impressed with Sean Fain. I mean, he came out very strong, very loud, but he's walked it.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see how the negotiations go, but I think the big thing that's going to be different here, obviously, is this is one facility. This is not all the VW.
Mm-hmm.
When he's talking to Ford, when he's talking to GM, he's talking to, I want to say Chrysler.
Fiat. Stellantis.
Stellantis, thank you. That was all of those U.S. facilities, okay, that he was basically talking to at that point. This is different. So how will VW respond to that? Are they going to say, you know what? I got four other plants here in the U.S.
Yeah.
And what am I going to do when something new comes out? Are we going to invest here, continue to invest here in Chattanooga? We're going to take that someplace else. I've also got 20 plants in China. I've also got another 5 plants in Mexico. So they have other options is all I'm saying here, as opposed to before when it was a much bigger party that was represented. The other thing here is, where does this go next? I mean, is mm-hmm. this just part of the wave? Because the next target is a Mercedes facility in
Alabama.
In Alabama, thank you. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out. I mean, is there going to be a middle ground? Is this going to be kind of one way or the other? The way the negotiations start, when that starts with this VW plant is going to be, I don't know, it's going to set off a wave one way or the other. It's definitely going to have, you know, you always describe this as having an impact on the industry going forward.
Oh, yeah.
This will, without a doubt.
Well, so it was 83.5% of the 4,300 people that work at the factory voted.
Yeah.
And when you talk about costly, right? Last fall, after UAW won, VW gave out 11% bonuses, which works out to about $67,000 per year on average, something like that. You know, that's $67,000, but under UAW contracts at GM, as an example, those same workers are making $75,000. So when we're talking about like an $8,000 difference, because I'm so good at math.
Took you a minute.
Yeah, man, I was working it out. I was processing. You got to see it in real time. I mean, Anna, that is going to be quite costly depending on how the negotiations go.
Yeah, I mean, it could be for sure, of course. But, you know, first of all, I think like this was a very strategic choice by the UAW to start here. Volkswagen has German roots, right? So mm-hmm. as a company, there are, you know, that's a very heavy union culture in Germany. And so, you know, a lot of observers were saying that like VW didn't push back on this very hard. They didn't campaign against the union. They kind of let the chips fall where they were going to fall. And, you know, maybe that is influenced how the vote turned out because there was not that pushback. Sometimes you get a lot of pressure on the employees and, you know, alternate campaigns and things like that, towing the line of what's legal. So in this case, I think for UAW to put this in their pocket as an early win, this was a right company to choose. And then, you know, if they can get some momentum at Mercedes-Benz, another German company, then, you know, maybe this kind of pushes some things forward. And I know that I think that you have to look at like the overall business prospects of operating in America. And it's not just that labor costs are lower potentially than doing it in Germany. But there's lots of benefits to making America your final country of assembly for these automotive products. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not necessarily like this is going to change things. I mean, it could, but it certainly could. But like, that's not the only reason that they're here, you know? Yeah.
I think there's two parts. I think there's a long-term, short-term. I think in the short-term, it won't be as, from VW's perspective or any of the automakers where maybe they have to now deal with a union labor group. In the short-term, I don't think it's going to impact things a ton. Obviously, costs might go up a little bit, but I think it's going to be longer-term. In other words, if they're rolling out a new product, if they're introducing a new line of vehicles, does the fact that they have to negotiate with a union labor versus another facility where they don't have to do that, mm-hmm. is that going to impact their decisions to expand or not, or how they're going to expand? I think that's what will be interesting to see how this plays out. Now, again, to your point, Anna, VW and all of these automakers in other countries, they deal with labor unions. Mm-hmm. Toyota deals with unions in Japan, okay? So this isn't a foreign thing to them.
Yeah.
And maybe we are just sort of blowing this up into a bigger thing, and corporately they're going, we've been here. We know how to handle this. But it will be interesting to see how everything plays out. And if UAW tries to immediately go for those same gains to sort of make everything a level playing field with their previous members, with their current ones. I mean, the geography, the economics is a lot different when we start getting into the southeastern part of the country as opposed to the heartland, the northeast. So, this is going to be a really interesting one to see how this one plays out.
Well, and also it can be not as big of an impact to VW, but still huge for auto workers in the region. So,
yeah. And I wonder how it's going to impact too, if this stuff goes through in terms of where people are working and if they want to stay there, if they are either potentially turned off by having to be in a union, are they going to want to go someplace else and vice versa? Is this going to be a recruiting tool potentially? Maybe VW sees that as well as a way, if they're quote unquote forced to increase wages and increase benefits, maybe they get better people too.
Yeah. I wonder what the churn rate is on how many people on average leave a facility after it unionizes or vice versa.
You know? Yeah.
What an idea for a potential article next week. all right. My, in case you missed it this week, I went with a story about Mercedes-Benz debuting what they called the future of delivery. Maybe that's what I called it. Mercedes-Benz had this pretty interesting new concept. On last Thursday, they announced a new logistics demonstrator that combines e-Sprinter vans with e-cargo bikes to solve the last mile problem. They call it the Sustaineer, for sustainability pioneer. Well, the tech demonstrator promises to look at delivery transport of the future. Now, I picked this story not just because the company is like developing a tech demonstrator to show what they could do, but they also developed this entire project with series production in mind. They made it more makeable. And that's why I thought it was cool. Not just because there are a series of these small trucks, which would carry these two rectangular cases filled with products that would then be delivered to an e-cargo bike, which would take them to the last mile, to the doorstep. I thought it was kind of cool that sometimes we see these demonstrators come out and they're just like, yeah, you know, certain technologies will be taken from this and put into production, where this was like, no, this entire thing was made with being makeable. So the concept was created in partnership with Onimotion, a German cargo bike manufacturer. The e-Sprinter actually acts as a mobile micro depot that brings rectangular containers filled with prepackaged goods and then transfers them to these cargo bikes that take them to the front door. The transfer takes a few minutes, so the e-Sprinter isn't idling for too long. And afterward, the van goes back to refill, back to the warehouse, whatever. And the bike continues along its journey. I think the concept makes sense for a lot of industries. The specific ones that Mercedes identified were express delivery, parcel services, bakeries, food suppliers, and companies that provide uniforms and other business textiles. Jeff, I don't know if you had a chance to check out this concept, but in terms of solutions that we've seen for last mile delivery, like I think it was Ford and Agility a few years ago, where like the humanoid robot deployed out of the back of the van and picked up the package to bring to the door. I mean, this is, you could legitimately, in my opinion, see this on bike paths fairly soon, depending on where you live.
I would agree. I mean, it's more palatable, I guess, than we've seen in some of the other ones for me, because I still kind of freak out about that, about some of the the footprint against the design and how it looks. But no, I think this is really interesting in the fact that it's backed by who it's backed by, and the companies that are involved with this also lends a lot of credibility to it. I think we've also got into this point where we're just so, even more so. We've always been, I want it now.
Yeah.
We want that even more so now. Just escalated and elevated. So for somebody like Mercedes-Benz to get behind it, we need a better name than the Sustainier.
Yeah.
Yeah. We need to do a little better than that. But again, especially when we want more people involved in this line of work, or we're going to need more people involved in this to make their job a little bit easier. Yeah, I like it.
And I also liked how it was pretty automated. It was a seamless sort of handoff from container on the van to the bike, and it seemed to go pretty quick.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and obviously there's a lot of problems that need to be solved with last mile. We know that for sure. That's where everyone gets tripped up in logistics, is how to like just complete that process. You know, if it were more of an autonomous delivery, I feel like maybe I would be more optimistic about it. The one thing I can think about just looking at this is staffing, and I feel like it's really hard to get delivery drivers now.
Yeah.
And then if it were me, like I would drive a delivery truck but I would not drive a delivery bike. Like yeah. I feel like if you're in a city or something and like there's 6,000 pound SUVs everywhere around you, and like, I mean, it's just like a more dangerous endeavor. It really is. I mean, so I could see like that not being appealing to people.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I kind of see that going the other way. Like, I think you could get a younger demographic potentially that is interested in this type of thing, because bikes have become more popular. You do see more people on bikes.
Maybe, but like, I don't know. I have friends who've lived in big cities, and like one of my friends was a bike messenger in New York City, and he was like, I almost died like every day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know it's not like that everywhere, but it's certainly not something I would do.
Well, it seems like protection and the predetermined routes are things that they've done for safety.
Mm-hmm. It's more robust than a bike. I mean, obviously, but.
But see, that's the other thing too, is like sometimes when I see more robust bikes, I think it does give drivers, both sharing the road and the bike riders, like a little more false sense of confidence.
Maybe.
You know, like, or of safety. So I do understand that. And I was just going to say like, yeah, I don't think they're trying to appeal to us to leave the podcast profession to go start riding bikes.
No, but I'm just saying like, I know that, but like just any person, you know, any person who's like, you know, if you're like even a little risk averse, you'd be like, I don't know.
Drew, it's a pass.
It's a pass.
A couple of things that really stood out to me too, in terms of innovations in the van. The vans have this driver heating and cooling concept that only moderates the temp closest to the driver's body. Mm-hmm. So Mercedes has been testing out this method, and so far it finds out they've significantly reduced the energy required to heat the cab, which will have a significant impact on range. And so if not for the Sustainier, I thought that's something that could be really powerful when it comes to other EVs on the market. The same was for the sort of cooling for the riders of the bike. They worked with another company, I think it was like Man and Handle, I don't remember actually now that I come up with that, on filtration technology. I guess I didn't realize how much particulate fumes and other things still get into the cab of a car in terms of what you're inhaling. And they have some pretty intense filtration that cuts it by like 98%. So, I mean, just something that I'm interested in learning a little bit more, seeing if it goes anywhere.
Yeah.
Anna, what's your In Case You Missed It this week?
So I selected a story about Mars, the candy company. I don't know if you're aware of them.
I'm familiar with some of their products.
Mm-hmm. This is what I consider kind of a unique story. It was about how Mars got involved with a company called Unreasonable Group. and their Unreasonable Group initiative to help select some notable startups in the food industry that they thought had some promise. So anyway, Mars is collaborating with this group. They helped select 15 what they call purpose-led growth stage ventures and their leaders for their potential to drive impact at scale across the food value chain. So the next stage after they picked this 15 company cohort is to work with them to positively impact sustainability goals, including Mars's net zero roadmap and 2030 goals of reducing emissions by 50% and beyond. So while there were many, and I encourage you to check out this article, here are just a handful of some of the companies that were selected. One is called Nitricity, and they produce distributed fertilizer production systems that make nitrogen fertilizer using air, water, and renewable energy. Sea Forest produces red seaweed-based feed additives that reduce cattle emissions by up to 90%, allegedly. That's incredible, right?
That is.
There's a company called Zampla that develops plant-based materials that mimic properties of traditional plastics but are entirely biodegradable. The ideas are so cool. I'd encourage you, like I said, to look at that full list. But ultimately, I like this story because of what Mars is actually offering to these companies. It's a cool program, I think. So the 15 companies will reportedly participate in a program that includes mentorship, access to resources and networks, and opportunities for collaboration with Mars and other industry leaders. The program aims to provide a catalytic effect on the growth and impact of these ventures toward the goal of a more sustainable and resilient food system for all. So, read another way, rather than just dump money into these companies, which of course is great too. Mm-hmm. I think Mars is offering more like leadership, you know?
Yeah.
Networking, collaboration, perhaps giving these new and emerging companies what they actually need from a peer, instead of being super competitive and keeping everything close to the vest, which of course they still will, but, you know, helping these guys get off the ground. And you know, I think these companies, they can fundraise anyway, but what they really need here is like how to establish good operational practices in an industry like food, how to understand market dynamics, things like that, where you don't always get that out of the gate. So I think it just goes to show that manufacturers can do more to enable sustainability than just popping a few solar panels on the roofs of their facilities. Like, they can do some of this stuff like at the ground level that probably makes more of a difference in the long run, but like helping elevate some of these other companies that really aren't competitive, and kind of help them get off the ground. And in the end, it's a great feel-good message for the people who care about what Mars is doing in the marketplace. So I was interested in seeing that. It just felt like a little bit different way to kind of address that sustainability issue.
Well, I can feel better about the like mini M&M shooters that I took out of the Easter baskets. Like, I know that that money was going to a good
shooters. Are they called that?
I mean, well,
M&M shooters.
I mean, you know what I'm talking about, like the little plastic tubes that are essentially, you know, M&M shooters. Well, and
I've never heard that before.
I mean, that's what all the kids are calling it these days. Oh, okay. Hey, Dad, have you seen my M&M shooter? I haven't seen it. No, Anna, one thing that kind of stood out too is they likely have first rights in acquiring these companies, maybe if they see a couple of winners emerge. Not that they will.
I don't know. Yeah.
Jeff, there are some pretty unique technologies that they are helping out here. Did any in particular stand out to you?
Well, a couple of them. First of all, I mean, any of these, there's three or maybe more than that that talk about like a feed additive. Mm-hmm. So if those can actually be made, and I think the biggest thing that Mars, a company like Mars, could step in and help these startups with is understanding how to price it to scale up. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at a lot of these food additives, and it's great that they're going to improve yield and all that kind of stuff, which to a farmer is great, but it still has to be more cost effective than growing hay and straw and feeding that to your cows or your crops, or excuse me, to your other animals. So, and if you can do that, and the trickle down effect of that is less field work. So you're in the field less, you're burning fewer emissions, you're releasing fewer emissions, you're able to remediate the soil, be a better conservative, you know, natural resource, you know, to manage all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But the one that also kind of stood out to me was LandScan, where it creates a digital twin of the farm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, I mean, that kind of bleeds into all of this IoT stuff that we're trying to get into agriculture, again, to help farmers be more efficient and run their own business just like anybody else would, with more data to make better decisions. So, really cool to see Mars really taking some leadership in this area, and hopefully others follow suit.
Well, for me, it was Voyage Foods, which they want to use reverse engineering and molecular biology to recreate popular foods like chocolate, only with different sustainable ingredients. And I mean, chocolate's been quite kind of a hot button one recently. So I really want to keep an eye on that one just to see how it works, right? Like, how much can they take a product, break it down to a molecular level, mm-hmm. essentially rebuild it sustainably. Like, that's wild to me. But I understand that, you know, they'll likely use some form of AI to make that happen a little bit faster. All right. Well, before we get out of here, let's get on with our final thoughts. Anna, what's your final thought this week?
Oh, no. Final thought. My son is playing on a soccer team and he is six and he does not know how to play soccer still. And it is the best. Like, I kind of don't want to teach him.
Yeah.
I know that I should do that because, like, for his own good, but, like, he just will run in whatever direction. Just runs, and like the entire time he's just huge smile on his face, just running after that ball. He does not care which goal he kicks it in. I don't think he's high-fiving everybody. He just loves being out there.
Yeah, he's there for the Spirit Award.
Yeah,
right?
So I'm just really enjoying this moment. I know at some point maybe he'll get competitive, but right now he's just really not, and he's just happy to be there. And that's the best kind of soccer. Nobody plays that way at the professional level. They like try to get goals in their mm-hmm, it's just like mm-hmm. what do you got? I mean, like, all right. If you want to be like that, and you want to win.
Any of the kids flopping yet at the six-year-old level?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
like,
yeah.
Where they're just mm-hmm. flying backwards. Mm-hmm. Like, where'd that come from?
I know. It's amazing.
Does he have a jersey?
No, their team is yellow. The yellow team. Sure. So he just wears like a Pokemon shirt.
That's solid.
Yeah. Looks good.
My final thought this week is we did have Dez's birthday, and it was fantastic. I would say that if you're ever looking for a spot for children, particularly younger children, to check out any local children's museum, just because there are so many hidden gems out there, and they just do a lot for the community, and there are a lot of different things that, you know, sneakily expose children to science and engineering initiatives, stuff like that. I also realized the benefit of having a child chiropractor. I don't know if I had told you guys this, but like my youngest is going through the like I'm the strongest phase. And so he wants to give really strong hugs. And the other night he went to like hug me, and he hugged my neck, and it just was like, brrr, like he blasted something free. And I was just like, where have you been?
Yes.
I have paid hundreds of dollars and they can't free that up. And he was just like, I'm strong, daddy. And I'm like, can you do that?
Yeah.
So
get licensed.
Yeah. Also, do not doubt the strength of a toddler. My goodness. I was just like, all right, I can still stand. Okay. Jeff, what's your final thought this week?
So I'm going to need some ROI calculations, schemes, strategies, because we helped out a family member recently, and my chore, if you want to call it that, was cutting the grass with his riding lawnmower. Oh. I hadn't been on a lawn tractor in a long time because like my yard takes an hour with a push mower.
Yeah.
But it was kind of awesome. I need to figure out how I can somehow like make the numbers work to, I mean, my wife wouldn't care. So I have to like make this make sense in my own head
yeah.
to actually justify getting a riding lawnmower, because it was kind of fun.
Well, you know, it's kind of, you got a little steep hill in the front there. And I mean, we're not getting any younger. So like, I mean, and what it takes for a knee replacement, that would easily pay for the cost of a lawnmower.
Right, you're helping.
Yeah.
You are helping.
I know.
I'm really trying to figure this out because I kind of enjoyed it. Even though it was a green tractor, which is kind of against family protocol. But
understood.
Try to get past that.
What color tractor is the family tractor?
Well, you know, with lawn tractors, we got to go orange.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Yeah.
Nothing green, nothing blue.
Yeah. Same. Got to be. We're an orange tractor family as well.
Yes.
Well, no, it's being like the only push mower in a neighborhood too. Like you watch them and you're just like, that's so unnecessary. And yet you're just like, and then they do the like zero turn and you're like, oh, that looks like so much fun.
Yeah.
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 All right. Well, before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily and weekly newsletter. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can join Doug and Jesse and Seth and everyone that joins us live when we're there at 2 p.m.-ish. For Jeff Franke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast. We'll see you next week.